So my talk today is going to be about, in general, something which is thought of as a kind of a vague notion, which is naturalness, but its interplay with kind of more concrete things we know about quantum field theory. So this is based on a paper that came out a couple weeks ago. Oh, I guess this is dead. A couple weeks ago with my grad student, Grant Remen, as well as some future work. So just to set the stage, here's my required slide on the kind of entire motivation for why we're interested in naturalness, which is physics at the weak scale. So as you all know, the LHC, our experimentalist colleagues at the LHC, have discovered a new scalar, the Higgs boson, which is extremely exciting and an amazing triumph. But there's a, oh, interesting. I see, because I'm in Canada. I'm not supposed to use this to defend myself. So I guess I can point, yeah, so they found a new scalar, but of course the upsetting question in everyone's mind is, well, where are all those extra degrees of freedom that we were promised? After all, since we were, you know, young babes, we were told when you have a light scalar in the spectrum that isn't natural, you have to have some additional degrees of freedom floating around to cut off those nasty quadratic divergences, keep your scale light, and consequently, there's always a prediction of some associated new physics. And of course, we haven't seen these states at all, and that's disconcerting. Now, you know, I think now certainly is a good time to kind of look at naturalness within the general context of quantum field theory, but I think it always should have been one, because it's very clearly a huge cornerstone of what has driven what we think about in Beyond the Standard Model Physics. Now, a lot of kind of soul searching has been happening in the last couple of years, no doubt because there's worries that we may not see anything at the LHC. Let me just list a couple of these ideas, not that I'm advocating any of them, but just to kind of be complete. None of these ideas, I think, are spectacularly new, and I'm going to go through them in kind of just random order. One idea, which I'll call regulator abracadabra, which is the idea that maybe if you use dim reg, then magically there's no power law divergences, so somehow we're safe. Of course, this was an idea that people thought about ages ago, and we know in the modern viewpoint is not a very tenable position, essentially because even in dim reg, even if you include, you know, even if you regulate with dim reg, there's still sensitivity to high scales. So for instance, if you take the standard model and you add to it some, you know, gut scale physics, which talks to the Higgs, then you naturally get finite corrections which are of order that high scale. So the idea of quadratic sensitivity persists even in such a theory where you kind of discard any intuitions from cutoff renormalization and just use a dim reg. Now, there's been some efforts among some people in phenomenological circles of kind of taking the dim reg viewpoint very seriously and just saying, well, let's just assume that the only thing we can compute is the finite piece. Let's ignore our intuitions from cutoffs and just ask how sensitive are we to new physics at high scales. So for example, Alessandro Strumia and his collaborators looked at some so-called modified naturalness principles where they essentially just do this, do dim reg and see how sensitive they are to the finite corrections from other scales. Now again, you have to change what you mean by naturalness in this sense, but I certainly like the fact that they can compute something and say something a little more concrete than just you know, how tuned is the model. They can actually exclude certain models and they have general predictions for what the scales of various beyond the standard model theories have to be. So theories like guts, axions, leptogenesis, et cetera. Another option, again, which I won't discuss, but I think is there has been some discussion about, has to do with kind of altering the ultraviolet in a somewhat magical way. The idea here is to essentially impose some conformal symmetry in the ultraviolet in such a way that the counter term for the Higgs somehow is not allowed and you can't write it down. This, of course, has its own issues, which I won't get into, but it's
shown directly that it doesn't work.
Yes, I know. Yeah. So you're talking about the paper by Schmaltz,
right,
and others? Yeah. So again, not advocating it. So let me point out that, so let me elaborate a bit on that. So the idea of this was to just have some conformal field theory that you kind of merge into at some high scale. But if I understand correctly, others have said this also, even without having actual physical thresholds, like physical mass spectrum, physical states, you know, giving you an actual cutoff, even if you just have running, which slowly merges into a CFT, that transition itself can induce a sensitivity to the ultraviolet. So as far as I understand, there's some real issues with this, and that's why I'm not advocating it here. Now, the last case is to, of course, just accept it, allow for some intermediate level of tuning. This would take many names, which like simply unnatural Suzy, split Suzy, mini split, et cetera, et cetera. So this basically says, well, we're not happy about it, but let's just let it be tuned. Now, so let me now draw like an analogy, which actually isn't at all helpful, but I find humorous, which is to compare each of these to the various stages of grief when one loses a loved one. In particular, let's say you know naturalness is your close friend from your youth, and you know they're a little sick, you're worried they're gonna die. You go through various stages, and it's very clear which of these stages is which. So regulator abracadabra is like just clearly denial. So the problem doesn't exist. These two are definitely a version of bargaining. So bargaining is when you kind of modify precisely what you value in some hopes that a vestige of what you want can survive. So these are not naturalness in their kind of initial incarnation, but maybe they have some naturalness left in them, and maybe something's preserved. And of course, mezzotuning is just acceptance. So this talk. I guess if it were to lie in the spectrum, it would be much closer to the acceptance stage. But I think it's more just an exploration of what we can say about naturalness without necessarily making additional assumptions. Okay, so unlike any of these in this talk, I'm not going to be imposing any new statements that we didn't know, years ago. And the main workhorse for this is something called, colloquially known as the weak gravity conjecture, which is based on a paper by Nimar Kani-Hamed, Lubosch Model, Berto Nicolas, and Kumud Vafa. Okay. So they actually made a number of conjectures and claims in this paper, but I'm going to discuss the one which is that they sharpened and were actually able to prove, and I'll show you essentially what that proof is, as well as some new arguments, which is our work. Okay. So what is the statement? I'm going to focus on this part of their claim, which is the following. If you have a long-range abelian force consistently coupled to gravity, then this requires the existence of some state with charge q, which is larger than its own mass in Planck units. Okay? So the statement here is not that it's not that every state has to satisfy this. That's not what it says. It just says that there must exist one state. So clearly, there can still exist totally neutral states as long as there exists some charge state which does satisfy this. So I'll show you justifications why this is true, but it's non-perturbative in the sense it's very hard to see, at least naively in perturbation theory, why this is required. But it appears to be a criterion or a consistency condition on any theory that's coupled consistently to gravity. And it's known as gravity is the weakest force conjecture just because it bounds the gravitational charge of a state by its electric charge. Okay. So let me give you just some pieces of evidence for this part of the claim. And again, I don't necessarily find any of the pieces of evidence except the last one to be really that convincing. But one evidence is just looking at examples. Okay, so you can look at lots of what seem to be healthy string theories and field theories, and you find that it is true. So as an example, just to illustrate, you could take a SU2 gauge theory. Whoa, I got loud all of a sudden. An SU2 gauge theory. Higgs down to a U1, you have some U1 subgroup that's like an electromagnetism. Of course, you have charged states, which are the W bosons from the gauge multiplet, and you can just ask what this implies. So this is essentially the condition of the weak gravity conjecture stated. It demands that the mass of this charged particle is bounded by its charge. So if I just plug in this usual expression, what do I find? I find that the VeV is bounded by M Planck. So the implication of this condition would be that the VeV can't exceed M Planck. Okay. Now, and similarly, you can do the same thing for monopoles. Now, one thing that I don't have to say, but is kind of obvious, is that you know proof by example is a very dangerous thing. Super Planckian VeVs, you know, maybe 2 weeks ago I would have been more skeptical of. But for those of you who know, after the BICEP 2 results, maybe there are super Planckian VeVs after all the lith bound may apparently be violated given that result. So again, we should not take this as a proof by any means, but it's certainly true of some theories that we think are okay. But this, I would say, is kind of circumstantial evidence. Another piece of circumstantial evidence is the fact that if you didn't have an obstruction of the type, an inequality of the form that I showed, then you can take a Q goes to zero limit, and you can worry about restoring an exact global symmetry. So probably a lot of you, at a young stage, thought, well, if I can take some gauge symmetry and just take the Q goes to zero limit, I can certainly restore an exact global symmetry. and exact global symmetries are forbidden. So what's going on? So if I take this strict limit, I will have a symmetry which is never broken in my Lagrangian without a long-range force, and that kind of manifestly violates well-known no-hair theorems, which tell us that stationary static black holes are labeled solely by mass, spin, and charge, and can't have any extra hair. Okay, so this is, not a proof, but gives you a reason for why there should be an obstruction to taking this Q goes to zero limit. Okay, now let me give you, in my opinion, what is certainly the best positive evidence for why this is true and why I believe it, which is a Gedanken experiment, which was presented by the authors of the original paper. And it's very simple. And one thing I want to mention about this proof that they have, I'll call it a proof, is that it requires extremely little knowledge about the details of quantum gravity. Okay, so what they only need for their proof, amazingly, is conservation laws and general relativity. Okay, and some basic assumptions about quantum gravity, which I think apply beyond any particular example of a quantum gravity theory. Okay, so let me tell you what the experiment is, the Gedanken experiment. So imagine you have some black hole with charge capital Q and charge and mass capital M, and imagine that it decays to some state, some, you know, many of one particle of charge little q and mass little m. Okay. What do I know from just conservation of charge and energy? Well, the number of states in the final state is just given by capital Q over little q. That's the number of particles. The total rest mass in the final state is thus given by little m times that. And by conservation of energy, this total rest mass must be less than the total mass of the initial state, okay, giving you this bound. Okay. Now, for an extremal black hole, famously, the kind of charge to mass ratio is saturated at the Planck scale. So if you plug in this expression into the top expression and ask, when can an extremal black hole decay, just based on its quantum numbers and based on what the final states can be, that places this requirement on the charge of the final state. Okay. So if this fails, if this inequality fails, then these extremal black holes are exactly stable remnants, and that's just a statement that there's literally nothing, no final state they can decay to. It's a statement just about conservation laws. Okay. Okay. So what? Well, yeah. So why are these bad? Good. So well, if they're exactly stable, then you have stable black hole remnants. And here's where I have to appeal to arguments that people make, which I actually won't justify in this talk, about apparent catastrophes that happen when you have stable black hole remnants. So just to list a couple. So I should say, people have thought about this a lot. I haven't, but others have thought about this in great depth, wondering whether you can solve things like the information problem by having stable remnants, which carry all that information away up to Scribe Plus. And people have brought up essentially a number of pathologies which are not linearly independent, but which I'll just name a few. There's a kind of a thermodynamic catastrophe, apparently, in the sense where, you know, if you have an infinite number of stable remnants labeled by some free mass parameter, then if I give you a room, where I have some statistical ensemble, then you will be strongly biased towards producing these stable remnants rather than any other state. So you can ask, you know, in an actual thermodynamic scenario, whether you'll overproduce these or whether every bath will be filled with black holes rather than any light state. But apparently, that's an issue for people. Yeah.
Both of these arguments depend on interpreting black hole entropy as the exponential, the log of the dimension.
I suspect that's true. I suspect that's true.
Rather than the dimension of the channel of information that can pass through the horizon.
Right, I think these would both depend substantially on that claim. In fact,
which is stronger than any of the original arguments from Bekenstein and Hawking.
Right, I think that's probably true. In fact, one of the reasons why we thought about this problem was that, well, I shouldn't say I feel uncomfortable with this, but certainly as more of a phenomenologist particle physicist, I don't feel I can totally justify these, but we wanted to find a different way of justifying the same claim. So again, I'm sure there's lots of things that go into this. I can't speak for how general they are, but I suspect that it does depend on that definition of the entropy. Again, also with the case of tension lithography. But this was exactly the reason we wanted to think about this, because while I do find this satisfying in the sense that with some assumptions you can take this to be something of a contradiction, a proof by contradiction, one would like in some sense a more geodesic argument. And that's what we actually started thinking about before even thinking about naturalness at all. So let me tell you about what we have been thinking about it and talking about. But let me actually generalize the question slightly before moving on to the other piece of evidence. Okay? So if you don't find this convincing, I'll show you another piece of evidence which we're thinking about. Okay, so first, let me generalize the story. The whole picture I discussed only had one particle species. I can imagine a theory with many species labeled by I. And as we'll see, it'll be very convenient to define a kind of charge to mass ratio quantity, which is essentially Q over M in Planck units for each state I, where for an extremal black hole, this is exactly saturated. So capital Z is 1. And then we can just state this inequality as the statement that there must exist some I such that Zi is greater than 1. Okay. Now, what is our role in this? So at this point, you know, when we saw this, we were interested in whether you could see whether something goes wrong if you fail this condition and you're just a low energy effective field theory. So I don't want to ask about what your UV completion is. I just want to look at your low energy field theory and ask whether something might be pathological. And very famously, there are some things you can say about a four-dimensional effective field theory without actually knowing the ultraviolet completion. Okay. So what is the approach here? So what we're doing is we're writing down the effective action just after integrating out that charge state. So integrate him out, and then you write down the effective action only involving the light states, which are the photon and the graviton. Okay. So this is essentially a generalization of the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian, which is the first two terms, but including loops that involve gravitons. So all these are generated by some loop of the charge state, you know, two photons on one side, two photons, or two photons, two gravitons, or four gravitons. Okay. And these just have some various coefficients. So the question was whether you can place some bound on any of these, and whether that could tell you or imply anything about the size of the charge to mass ratio. So it turns out there is something you can say. So I don't have a slide on this, but I can write it down. Basically, there's a reason you would expect something like this to be true, which is that if I just turn off gravity, something like this is true. Okay. So famously, if you imagine turning off gravity, setting LFR and LR to 0, you just have the top line. Then it turns out that without even, you know, so if you integrated out the electron, you'd find that A1 and A2 are both positive. You would just find that experimentally. And you might keep trying to integrate things out, and you keep finding that A1 and A2 are positive. But as it turns out, there's actually a general reason why A1 and A2 have to be positive. And that's the kind of approach that we're taking. So in other words, A1 and A2 are strictly positive. And this has been shown many ways. One was effectively through dispersion relations. So you can look at the 2-to-2 photon scattering amplitude induced by this effective operator, by A1 and A2. And you can apply a type of positivity argument where you relate the cut of some, you basically do dispersion relation calculation. You relate its cut to some forward scattering amplitude, which is positive. And that positivity constraint gives you the constraint that A1 and A2 are positive. So that's just a derivation from field theory that A1 and A2 are always positive, if you believe in an analytic S matrix. Okay? Now, another way to see it, which is actually the approach I'll mention in the next slide briefly, is to use backgrounds. Okay, so another way you can show this was that A1 and A2 are positive was shown by Nima, Arkan Hamed, and Alan Adams, and collaborators. And what they essentially did was put down a background field strength. So imagine a universe that has some electric field flux flowing through it, and just ask about photon propagation in that universe. And you can see that if I just set F squareds to their backgrounds, this will modify the dispersion relation for photons traveling that background. And you can see that only for A1 and A2 being positive, that you'll have subluminal propagation of those modes. Okay. So it's kind of an involved argument, but basically you put in a background electric field, and only when A1 and A2 are positive do you have subluminal propagation. So this connection between superluminality, if you think superluminality is a bad thing, then that would tell you also that A1 and A2 are both positive. Okay. So the idea here was to apply kind of a similar argument to this. And again, this should be a talk mainly about naturalness, so let me just tell you one of our conclusions, which is, well, you can just look at how these operators scale. These A, B, and C coefficients, they all scale with some power of Z, where Z is some factor, Z is Q over M, I showed last time. So the idea is, can you place some constraint on A, B, and C? As I mentioned before, in the non-gravitational case, you can set bound positivity bounds on A. And what we essentially did was look in certain backgrounds and ask when the propagation becomes superluminal. And without showing the calculation and many subtleties that enter into the question of superluminality in curved spacetime, let me just say as a fact, we found that photon propagation is modified in an FRW universe essentially because, you know, R gets a VeV in some sense, F squared gets a VeV. There's a background value for them. And in that background, the photons will be superluminal unless Z, which is Q over M, is greater than some number, which you can compute. Okay. So this would be an argument from superluminality, if it offends you, that that you need to satisfy this constraint that Z is bounded by some number. Yeah?
There's this paper by Drummond and
Hatrell. Right.
Black hole background.
That's right. Right, so this relates to the fact that there's issues with superluminality in curved spacetime. In that case, there's a lot of arguments as to whether that's pathological or not. What I would say here is the reason why I feel slightly more comfortable about this in FRW is that it's a conformally flat spacetime, where I should expect somehow that the causal structure should be a little closer to a flat spacetime, as in contrast with Schwarzschild. But this is exactly the type of question we're trying to understand, which is that it's very tricky when superluminality is a bad thing, where you can make a closed time-like curve or not. So certainly if we could construct a closed time-like curve, that would be a success, but we haven't been able to yet. For this reason, we've been thinking about other ways of bounding this using thermodynamic arguments, et cetera. But it's exactly the type of issue that we're worried about.
But why not consider the two scattering for the second operator?
Okay, so we also looked at that. So the problem with 2-to-2 scattering is that in order to define a forward cross-section, you need your forward cross-section to not be infinite. But here we have gravitons, which can be exchanged in the T-channel. And in the forward limit, that's formally infinite. So there's like this stupid technical obstruction to applying the usual dispersion relation. So this doesn't happen if you just have a contact operator after the fourth. There's no the forward cross section is not infinite. But this is a little bit like Sommerfeld enhancement. You can have photon exchange at glancing angle, and the forward cross section is infinite. So because the expansion in partial waves doesn't converge, we can't use the usual machinery we'd use for positivity. Now that doesn't mean we can't go off forward and try to do some tricks, and we're actually thinking about that. But it looks quite tough. And I don't think these are unrelated things. The fact that there is a T-channel singularity that's obstructing us from gravitons, and the fact that there's these issues about the metric and what superluminality means, I think these are actually linearly dependent.
Maybe yeah. I misremembered, but isn't it true that in the recent proofs of AFD or so, strictly speaking, they also use the same kind of positivity arguments?
Right.
Strictly speaking, it's a bit more subtle than in the example you just gave, right? Because they also all these cuts, it's a bit subtle.
So there's some subtlety with cuts, and
with a bound, right?
Well, so I'm not sure. You mean even without gravity, of course, just for the A theorem. I wasn't aware that there was any huge subtlety in Zohar's proof for that reason. What do you mean exactly? My understanding was the argument's pretty simple. You just, we can discuss it, but you take the amplitude, you divide by some power of S, and you expand the contour, and you relate to the discontinuity on the axis. Maybe there's some subtleties with the boundary term. Maybe that's what you're referring to. Right. But I think there's arguments for why that. My understanding was that his proof was okay, but I'm not an expert on his A theorem proof. So. But these are all issues that we have to try to understand.
What's the constant?
It's.
The larger, smaller one.
it's in the way that is consistent with which is consistent. It goes in the right direction. Yeah, it's not less than one. Yeah. Or it's not, yeah. It's in the way where it's automatically satisfied by z is greater than one. Yeah. So this was kind of a digression. But let me get to the meat of why I'm discussing this. So there's one aspect of this bound which I haven't discussed at all, which is radiative corrections, okay, which is the effects of loops, as well as actually kind of generalizing, which I'll do a little bit later. But what's the crucial effect that I've totally neglected? It's the fact that Q and M are not just fixed parameters. Depending on where you are on the energy scale, they can change, and they're renormalized quantities. Now, given the arguments that you've seen, they all seem to intrinsically involve the physical pole masses, right? If I'm talking about the kinematics of the decay of some extremal black hole, it cares about the actual final state masses. So it's very reasonable to say, well, I should evaluate all these things, the charge and the mass at the pole mass. That seems like a reasonable thing. But here's where something is interesting kind of happens, which is that if you just look at this bound, for the case where the charge state is a scalar, then this actually bounds something which is radiatively unstable by something which is radiatively stable. Okay. So for the case where if I have a theory where the particle in question is a scalar particle, then this is a very odd type of bound. Okay. That's essentially the essence of our observation, which in some sense is pretty obvious just from this. Now let's try to make this a little sharper. Okay, so let me fix the theory. Okay, so I'm just going to take scalar QED. We want to look at this in just the simplest case. Write down all the renormalizable type couplings I can have. There's a quarter coupling, and then there's some charge minimal coupling to the photon. So phi here is some type of selectron. I'll just call it that for ease of nomenclature. Now let's just ask what this implies for scalar QED. Okay, so again, I'm fixing the spectrum and asking what this implies about it. Now you can see what the tension is, which is the following. So there's some physical mass scale. I could take this electron and I could fix its tree level mass, let's say, m squared to some value. But you know, our usual intuitions as effective field theorists is that this gets dragged up. In this theory, it's scalar QED, so it gets dragged up all the way to some Planck scale cutoff, some very high scale. Now, what's strange about this? Well, there's a bound Q times M Planck, which bounds this charged particle to be less than that, right? The bound that Q is greater than M over M Planck is just a statement that this guy's physical mass is actually less than Q times M Planck. So what this means is that you actually have, in this theory, for it to ever be consistent, this selectron has to be inside this window and not above it, okay? Far below its natural region in this case. Yes? I'll discuss that. Yeah, I'll discuss that. I have a whole discussion on that, yeah. For the moment, let me assume it's unHiggsed. But it's actually interesting the case when it is Higgsed. And that'll be one of the exceptions I'll discuss. Yes?
U1 does not have asymptotic freedom. So there's a Landau pole.
Right.
What about them?
Well, I was imagining here a cutoff below that given just by coupling to gravity. So this was like a U1 coupled to gravity. So my cutoff here can be the Planck scale, which would be below where that Landau pole happens. In that case, well, I could still call my cutoff where that Landau pole happens, and I could still make this bound, this QM Planck, much less than that Landau pole. So the claim here is not that for every theory this is true, but there exist theories for it to be true. I think you could come up with a theory where the Landau pole happens below the Planck scale, below Q times the Planck scale, and I have nothing to say about this. So certainly my claim is not that there is always a tension between naturalness and this claim. It's just that for some theories there will be. So you gave an example where it may not be. Problem.
QCD does not have a naturalist problem. QCD.
That's right. Right. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. So again, as I said, I'm not claiming that every theory has an issue. I'm just saying that some would. That's right. In fact, yeah, that's right.
Does it depend on the symmetry being abelian?
Yeah. So this is actually. So that's an interesting question. So. As far as I know, there hasn't been much said about this. I can tell you, so I don't know, strictly speaking, whether you should demand that gauge couplings for a non-abelian gauge theory has to be bounded above M over M Planck. My intuition, though, is that if you have an unbroken non-abelian gauge theory, the gluons are essentially massless states which are charged. So I almost feel like they would trivially satisfy the bound. That's my intuition, but I haven't thought very much about that case. I think it would be interesting to ask how it generalizes. I will talk about generalizations of this bound, but involving many U1s in many states, but not for the non-abelian case.
That's trivial, right? Because your gauge coupling can run to.
Yeah, yes, I agree. It's definitely less trivial than
that. You don't have as much freedom because you cannot change the charge, but you can change the coupling.
Right, that's right. No, I'm not saying it's trivial, but I'm just telling you my zeroth order intuition. Yeah. So again, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if anyone's looked carefully at that question, actually.
So you are assuming that this is the whole particle content mm-hmm. theory, right?
Yes. And I'll tell you what happens. Well, I'll tell you what happens when I add additional things. So that's entirely the assumption here: is that at fixed spectrum, fixed parameter space, what can you conclude? So that's very important. Yes. Yeah, so I'll discuss that. Yeah, I can add. I'm going to talk about all these, the Higgsian case, adding states, and then actually another option also. But at present, if I'm just talking about scalar QED at fixed theory, this is just true. Let me just quantify precisely what the issue is, because again, it's still, even going to the numbers, it's not totally obvious there's a problem. In particular, we have to quantify the tension. So imagine that I take the mass squared and I renormalize it by some delta m squared. It's some quadratically sensitive mass parameter, and I can have kind of two contributions, one coming from loops of gauge bosons and one coming from loops. This is from gauge bosons, this is from just loops of scalars. And A and B are incalculable coefficients. So there's a number of ways of kind of shuffling around the same uncertainties. You could say that I computed these in some scheme, but then I have a counter term, which I don't know the coefficients of, and when I add them, then I get some order one reshuffling these parameters. But irrespective of that, what naturalness tells us, or what the principle would claim, is that after adding all those counter terms, A and B are not parametrically small. They're not very small, but they're actually order one things. I don't consider loops of gravitons in this case. I think I could also include them. I think that would be fine. Yeah. So if you like, I could also include them. You mean just the, one over m Planck. Yeah. I think I could also, and I put a coefficient of one there, I guess. That's right. Yeah. I think that won't change the argument. Yeah.
If you perform a minimal subtraction, you can produce the quadratic divergence to a log. You get m squared log m squared times log m squared from u squared.
Right.
So this is for the renormalized quadrature.
Right. So I think if you took a viewpoint of naturalness where your intuitions from cutoff renormalization are out the window, then there is, I guess, a position you could take where if you apply a dim reg, then you only have finite and running pieces, and you could just include those. And that was the finite naturalness story I discussed at the beginning. But I want to still preserve the intuitions I have from cutoff renormalization. That's why I'm using it in this case.
Why?
I think it would be fair to say the general viewpoint of how naturalness works is that this thing here really is present. In dim reg, you wouldn't see it unless there was a physical threshold. But I think when people talk about naturalness, they typically assume that you don't need a physical mass threshold, just high energy loops of whatever stuff is going around the loop can give you an actual cutoff divergence. So I'm talking about this because I want to talk about the canonical naturalness principle discussed in circles that care about naturalness. You could take a different viewpoint, in which case you would ascribe to modified naturalness principles. But I should say those have their own issues. For instance, I think there's some scheme dependence and even what you would define as the correction and so on. So they themselves are not entirely well-defined. That's at least my understanding. But for this, I'm taking the usual picture of cutoff renormalization.
If you have m squared times log m squared from u squared.
Right.
And if you have anything above the top mass, dead.
Right. Well, yeah, that's right. Like if something was at 2 times 10 to the 16 GeV. Yeah. I mean, yes. Okay, so any other comments or questions? So let me just compute whether there's a tension. I could also imagine, if you want to add gravity and just call this B lambda 1 if you want. Now I could set, I'm essentially going to set the physical mass of the state equal to its natural value, its radiative correction. So I'm going to take this quantity Z, which I defined, and just plug in for M what I just computed, where A and B are these coefficients. And since there's only one state in the spectrum, I kind of unfairly forced you into a given spectrum, this implies that Z is greater than 1. So I can take this expression and say that it's greater than 1. And that gives a bound on lambda. Okay. So whatever thing is flowing around in the loop momenta, that cutoff, is bounded. Now what it's bounded by depends on important hierarchy between these couplings, Q squared lambda. Okay. Now in the limit where Q squared is bigger than lambda, which is actually, I don't think Q squared can actually be much, much bigger than lambda because lambda will generate Q squared. But if you imagine taking this limit, then this is what you get for the bound, and it's actually a very reasonable type of bound, which would just tell you that the loop cutoff is sub-Planckian. Now, that at least seems like a reasonable outcome. What is strange that happens, something strange happens in the opposite limit where Q is much, much less than lambda. And that's here, you can see, if I had gravity loops, B lambda would just be something like 1. But the basic point is that I would have some parametrically lower cutoff. Okay? for some unknown reason at present. So just viewing from the effective field theory, this should just mean that whatever is rolling around those loops is just parametrically lower. That's exactly just the mathematical restatement of what I was drawing in pictures before. Okay? So that's reasonable. This is parametrically below Planck. Now, what you take from this is now up to you, of course. You could say, well, naturalness always wins, and thus that means I must have naturalons at the scale. That's a perfectly tenable option, which I'll now also discuss. But at present, you don't actually know what's actually cutting off this this divergence. Okay. So what is the lesson here? So at least restricting to the case of scalar QED, I think there's something kind of odd that's happening, which is that if you just take scalar QED plus gravity, there is part of its natural parameter space which is in the swampland. So it just can't happen. It is forbidden by this condition. There's other reasons why it might be forbidden, certainly, but it's not allowed. And more generally, you know, just because of the structure of this inequality, Q greater than M over M Planck, there can be, in principle, a tension between fundamental scalars and this criterion. So this is really the question you want to ask. But you can, of course, change the theory, which is what I'll discuss. And these are very obvious things you can do, which, of course, we discuss in our paper. So what can you do to reconcile naturalness and weak gravity without doing very much? And I think two of these things were already asked as questions. So one is you can just change the theory. So I don't want to talk about scalar QED. I'm not allowed to do that. I have to add some new degrees of freedom. So this picture here was that this gets dragged up, and I don't want that to happen. So of course, what you can do, I'll call this option A for adding degrees of freedom, is add an electron. Okay, why? And the reason I call this an electron is because it's related by symmetry to this electron. And the idea here is that it should cut off this divergence in some way to make this natural, such that it is bounded by this. Okay, this is yeah.
Would it be equivalent just to not have a fundamental scalar field? That of course
sounds like. Yes, you could also just, yeah, okay, fair enough. You could say that there is no fundamental scalars.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's already very naively intentional.
Right, I guess that is another tenable position. That's right. Yeah, I agree. Of course, observing the Higgs is evidence that that there are some scalars that are at least quasi-fundamental. But I guess a tenable position. Fair enough, yeah. I guess you could argue that it has to be some everything's fermions or higher spin. You could argue that. I didn't list that, but
the cutoff scale at which they're resolved has to be considerably higher than the Higgs mass.
That's right, but not up to the Planck scale. He's saying, but not up to the Planck scale, right? So he could be composite. It could be the compositeness scale could be at 100 TeV, and then that claim would be true. So I agree. Yeah, that's right. That might fit more nicely into the second option, which I'll discuss. But indeed, you could just forbid the theory from existing. Scalar QED doesn't exist, you could also say that. Elementary scalar field, yes. I should be clear about that. Doesn't exist rigorously. Yeah, that's a tenable position. Yeah. I think there are some people who, that's possible. Good, so now well, let's just look at this particular case, in the case where there is a selectron and I cancel its divergences. So this, of course, resolves naturalness with the condition, but of course it resolves naturalness entirely. So it's totally unsurprising that if I don't have a naturalness problem because I cut off my quadratic divergences, there's no tension of naturalness with anything because your theory is natural. So from the point of view of this, exploration is uninteresting. Of course, it's interesting experimentally, but it's interesting from the point of view that obviously there's no tension between anything when your theory is absolutely natural. Okay? There's another option, though, which is, from this point of view, much more interesting, where you add a new state, which just has nothing to do with the state. So the selectron gets dragged up, you add a new state, a muon, who could care less about the quadratic divergences of the selectron, doesn't cut off anything, this guy's heavy, and then these new states just satisfy the condition, and then you can ignore the heavy state. And that's perfectly tenable. So in these cases, you could just add degrees of freedom. Okay? I'm not saying this can't happen, and this is why we discuss this at length in our paper. This is one kind of the most obvious thing you could do. I find this much more interesting because it doesn't solve this guy's naturalness problem. It just predicts a new state that's light. Another option is kind of restricting the theory. So we didn't say this, but I guess you could say maybe you're not allowed to have any fundamental scalars. You could also say I'm not allowed to take this hierarchy. This hierarchy is somehow disallowed. A very small q squared is technically natural. Under RG flow, it's preserved. But you could imagine easily that it's somehow forbidden in some ultraviolet completion D terms is kind of a toy idea for that, but of course you need something much more than Suzy to justify this. But I should say, even if you're allowed like somewhat hierarchical couplings, you know, if Q squared isn't way, way, way less than lambda, but just like modestly less, then you would still, in this, in it, even with this exception, have little hierarchies in your spectrum. Okay. And then the last case, which I think Mina was alluding to, which is that, well, I assume this whole case that I was in the unbroken phase. And it may seem like the technical point, but imagine that you have delta m squared generated and it's, you know, huge, it's at its natural value, but it turns out to be negative, right? I can't compute its incalculable sign, so it could have tachyonized the theory, in which case the U1 would have been spontaneously broken. And in this case, again, this is maybe an area for future work, but I don't know what the generalization of this conjecture would be in the Higgs phase for a number of obvious reasons. One is that when I say I bound Q and M, who's Q and who's M, right? If I have a Higgs phase and I can mix states of different charges and different masses, so it's not even well defined because Q and M are not commuting operators. More importantly, in terms of the actual justification, the reason that that we have the most reason to believe the bound comes from extremal black holes, and that intrinsically used the fact that that the U1 was a long-range force, right? That you have a conserved charge that I could use to compute the number of final state particles. And if the U1 is Higgs, then there's absolutely no justification for that. So for instance, if I took a black hole and I just Higgs the U1 ever so slightly, the black hole would not be eternal. It could just shed its U1 hair and then evaporate. So it was very important that it actually was charge stabilized. So if there's no charge, then that doesn't happen. Okay, good. So I'm going a little bit slow, but let's keep going. So of course, you know, if we want to connect this story.
One more question.
Yeah.
Isn't there a fourth way out that doesn't change the low energy effective theory at all, which is just to add some really heavy, barely sub-Planckian, but hugely charged state?
Yes, its charge would have to be enormous,
yeah,
given charge quantization. But yeah, that's, I would actually put that, morally speaking, I guess.
Morally, it's like your 1B.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Except that
this guy,
you can see the effective theory. Whereas my gigacharge,
I agree. So in other words, the assumption here was that charge quantization forced the charges to be of similar size, which is why I put this mu1 here. But you're saying I could put the mu1 up here and just make its charge even bigger.
Yeah,
so
charge,
I agree.
Charge 10 to the 23.
If it had charge 10 to the 23, then that would work. That's right. I would just put, we could discuss it, but I would also put this in this category.
Right. Except that it's something in effective field theory that wouldn't see at all, right? That's the only distinction I made.
That's right. I guess maybe I should be worried about the number of units difference in charge quantization, because it's not just that you're taking a charge small, you're taking the difference in the ratio of two charges to be 10 to the 20, which feels odd, but you can do it. But I think you can do it, as long as it's an integer. That's right. Yes, that's another tenable possibility. So you put it at the Planck scale with a 10 to the 10 charge. That's right. I would think of those as somehow simpler if you're willing to add things in that case. Good. So I think I'm way behind, but let me try to speed up. So so one thing that we did in our paper, which is already out, is actually try to understand what you do with weak gravity in a kind of more realistic theory where you have multiple forces and multiple charge states. So in the standard model, of course, we do have many gauge groups. I won't have anything to say about the non-abelian story, but you can imagine a theory with many U1s, and under each of those U1s, many different charge particles. Okay, so now there's immediately an ambiguity when I say that the charge is bounding M over M Planck, because I have to say whose charge under which U1, and whose map. So like, what is the expression that I should be even trying to impose? Okay, and that hadn't yet been generalized. So that's what we did. So how would you do this? So what I'm going to consider is a U1 to the n theory of just a multiple force theory, where I have photons which kind of intrinsically form an SON multiplet. So at least their kinetic terms are invariant under an SON transformation of those states. As you might imagine, it'll be convenient to write everything in terms of an SON symmetry. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll define charge vectors, where for any charge of a given species I, it has charge QIA under photon A. Okay. Now, So A labels the different U1s and the different photons, I labels the different charged particles. Now, since there's a kind of embedded SON symmetry here, I'm just going to rewrite all these charges as vectors in this SON space. So I have a QI vector just pointing in some charge direction. And I can likewise define SON covariant charge to mass vectors just like this. So it's all an analogy to before. I'm just bootstrapping all the Qs into a generalized just charge space. Okay. Now, you could ask, if I were to just posit what the generalized condition would be, if I were to guess what it would be, what properties would it have? Well, it would be clearly SON invariant. And let's guess what it might be. So maybe it's the possibility, maybe it's a statement that there must exist at least one particle, one state, for which the absolute value of Zi is greater than one. Okay, so pick, there's some ith guy whose magnitude of his charge vector is greater than one. But this is kind of obviously not sufficient, because if I have some very large charge state in one direction, I can always produce a black hole in an orthogonal direction, an orthogonal charge direction that wouldn't decay. Okay? So the name of the game is I want to be able to place a bound so that every possible black hole can decay. This condition would not be sufficient to preserve the stability of black holes in orthogonal directions. Now, you could ask for actually what seems like a much more stringent criterion, which is that I require that for every single force direction, for every single U1, there exists a charged particle with charge in that direction such that Zi is greater than 1, okay? Which seems like a much stronger criterion. Just go along each axis and demand that this is satisfied. In this case, I can't use the same argument from black holes. But again, this actually is still not sufficient, despite sounding even more stringent. So let's stop theorizing about what it might be and just derive what it is from the general argument. So you can do this very simply. Just by the same Gedanken experiment that Niemann and friends discussed. And that is this. So you take some black hole, it has a charge vector, capital Q, and decays to some set of states, in this case, many species. So it's decaying to some number of each species. Okay? So the idea here is that the black hole decays to ni particles of a given species I. Okay? Now, from charge conservation, we know this is true. From energy conservation, I know that this is true. Okay. And then I can just recombine these and reshuffle them in a particular way. Okay. So these are, again, the same two equations. But let me go to kind of different variables. So there's a sigma I variable I can use, which is literally the fractional mass in the final state. So in my final state, I can just add up the total rest mass of a given species and then divide by the total mass, and that's what I get here. So these sigma I's are some kind of measure of how much energy is going into each species. And in terms of these sigma i's, I get this bound. Okay. So the claim that you have a black hole, extremal black hole, or actually any state which can decay, is the claim that z can be written as this, and furthermore, this is true. Okay. Now, maybe this looks a little bit formal, but there's a nice geometric way to read this picture. Okay. So sigma I here, being a fractional mass, is strictly positive. So what this tells me is I have some ensemble of numbers, sigma I, whose sum is bounded by 1. And this state, capital Z, which corresponds to the initial state, has to decay to a bunch of Zi's such that their weighted sum is equal to the original Zi. So there's the geometry picture here is that this actually defines a convex hull spanned by the vectors Zi. That is to say, if you just take the SON space and draw the Zi vectors, and then draw the hull that is spanned by those, which bounds those vectors, that gives you a space of capital Z's which can decay. Okay, so let me show you this an example. That's a little bit formal, but let's just do this for the simple case of U1 squared in two charged states. So I have a two-dimensional space, so this is kind of like, you know, photon 1 and photon 2, and I'm gonna draw different charges in this space. Imagine that I introduce two charged states, 1 and 2. So Z1 is the charge to mass ratio of the particle of particle 1. This is the charge to mass ratio for antiparticle 1. And this is particle 2 and antiparticle 2. So they come in conjugate pairs because of CPT. So these are just the charges. What I just argued before was that if one defines some convex hull which contains this whole object, that is essentially the weighted sum of the Zi's summed with sigma I less than 1. So anything, in other words, any initial state with charges inside this convex hull can decay. Okay. Now, what we know is that black holes have unit charge. So they essentially constitute the unit circle, the unit disk. And since the unit disk is contained inside this convex hull, all these states can decay. Okay? So that means that any extremal black hole, which would be on the boundary of this disk, any neutral state, which is in the center, can decay because it's contained inside this convex hull. Now, we can consider an alternative theory where the condition fails. Okay? So here's where that would happen. Imagine I have, you know, just different charges. So same U1 squared theory, but with different charge assignments. In this picture, I draw the convex hull, and then I draw the unit ball. Okay? Now, this is meant to illustrate the reason why one of our conjectures failed before for what the generalized version would be. In this theory, along each axis, z is bigger than 1. Right? Z is bigger than 1 here, z is bigger than 1 here. It's bigger on each axis. But just because of Pythagoras, it's not bigger along any arbitrary axis, which is just another way of saying that there's regions of this circle here which lie outside the convex hull. So in spite of the fact that this guy has, in some sense, maximal charge, this guy has maximal charge, there's still kind of bi-charged states which are completely stable because there's no final state they can go to. So this would be an example which actually fails the weak gravity condition, despite the fact that on each axis it seems to satisfy it separately. Okay? What does this mean? This means that as I add more U1s, there's actually a more stringent bound at larger n. So in fact, you could ask, you know, if I keep this kind of diamond shape, how big does the diamond have to be to contain this circle? It's clear it has to be root 2 here. Right? So rather than z being greater than 1, z has to be bigger than root 2. And that was entirely a consequence of the fact that this is a two-dimensional space. If I go to n u1s, then it goes as root n. Okay? And this is related to some of the statements Diwali has made about large n species and so on, which I think I have no time to talk about. So let me just hurry up a bit. So this was the story for weak gravity. Okay? So let's return to the standard model. And what can we learn? So, of course, those options can hold, and I don't honestly have an argument for why there's a reason they can't. But those are the logical possibilities as a low energy effective field theorist. But if they don't, then something interesting happens, right? So if I imagine that there aren't, if I imagine I'm just living in a scalar QED theory with no new degrees of freedom, I fix that theory, then even for a smallish value of Q, then I can have modest hierarchies. And I don't think of Q of 10 to the minus 3 as particularly small. So in this sense, there can be some relationship between small mass parameters and ultraviolet consistency. So in some sense, this is maybe a rewording of the statement that maybe tunings are even more of an ultraviolet mystery than we would even expect. Because sometimes they can be enforced in your low energy theory without any reason that might be clear to you as a low energy effective field theorist. Now, I can't not mention this, so let me briefly mention this. This, which is, you could ask what this might say for the big hierarchy problem, and I'll say something about it essentially because it has an experimental prediction. So let me imagine that I want to do the exact same thing with the hierarchy problem. It naturally drags the electric weak scale up to some high scale. I want some small q to save me from this and prevent me from having an unnatural mass scale. Now, I'm going to do the same, if you like, unfair constraint that I did for scalar QED, which is to fix the theory. I'm going to fix the theory so that I have some new U1 where Q has a small value. Okay? You might be tempted to try to use hypercharge, but the hypercharge coupling is way too big for what I'm about to try to do. What you can do is introduce a new U1 with a very small charge Q. And the entire essence of this, just like in the scalar QED example, is to relate the mass of this guy to relate the electroweak scale to the mass of some state which is charged under that U1. So the picture is essentially the following. So if there's some mass scale that floats with the electroweak scale, you could have asked, why doesn't the electroweak scale float all the way up to the Planck scale? Well, it's prevented from doing so because if that other state was too large, then you would violate the bound. So for when this within this effective field theory with this fixed spectrum, that's just a true fact about the. Yes, it still assumes U1 is unbroken. That's right. That's right. It has to be unbroken. That's right. That's why there's an experimental prediction, actually. So let me show what that is. So let me just comment on one thing before showing that experimental prediction, which is that this is a totally backwards way of thinking about, admittedly backwards way of thinking about the issue, which is not that the weak scale is natural. It's not saying it's natural. In fact, it's saying it's unnatural. But the kind of more natural values might be forbidden by some type of ultraviolet consistency condition. Okay. But in terms of the massless U1, this is the main reason why I think this ended up in a paper, which is that we actually have a prediction because the U1 can't be broken for it to work. So to do this, what you do is you gauge B minus L. This is the simplest model that one can think of. To accommodate neutrino masses, you make them Dirac. There's some small Yukawa coupling here. We don't actually know the absolute mass scale of the neutrinos, of course. But if I assume that the lightest neutrino is of order the usual limits we see around 0.1 eV, then we can then fix Q for the B minus L. Okay? So I'm going to fix it to this particular value. This is just the theory that I fix. And I'm picking this very, very small number for a specific reason, which is that for this value, 10 to the minus 29, that exactly coincides with M neutrino over M Planck. And specifically, the reason why this connects electroweak scale to anything is that the VEV controls the neutrino mass. So the picture here is that if V was any higher, if you dragged it up to a higher scale, this would also drag up M neutrino, but M neutrino is exactly saturating the inequality given this value of the charge Q. Okay. Yeah?
So the heat is not charged at
100.
No. Yeah.
That's right. It's not charged on the U1. That's right. But it controls the mass of a state, which is charged on the U1. If you tried charging the Higgs under it,
yeah,
it wouldn't work.
Because
it would be Higgs. Yeah. And that's the first thing we did, and we're like, oh, this just doesn't work. And then this was the obvious next thing to do. Yeah.
I have a question about the so-called gauge hierarchy. You're talking about delta M squared. The gauge
delta M squared.
QCD does not have a gauge hierarchy.
Right.
Because of asymptotic.
Yes, I agree.
So how does this, do you have anything to say about
that? This is trying to solve the
gauge
hierarchy problem.
Yeah, the statement.
So I'm not saying anything about QCD. I'm talking about the electroweak hierarchy problem.
The argument is the following. Because the U1 has another goal, right?
Right.
This another model, it predicts a new scale. That another goal is above the Planck scale. So the statement is here in this picture that somehow quantum gravity is what fixes, you relate gravity is what.
Oh, so by gauge hierarchy problem, you mean the Landau pole?
He means the Landau pole.
Oh, I see. Right. Well, that's above the Planck scale. That's above the Planck scale.
Doesn't
in this case. It doesn't matter in this case.
Yeah.
In QCD, because of asymptotic Friedel, it goes like 1 over log Q squared.
Right.
So you get an exponential suppression between the electroweak.
Right. Yeah. As you go higher and higher energy, you can get the coupling to be smaller. Right. Yeah. For non-abelian gauge theories, I still have just less of an understanding of what the general bound is. I don't. I took the standard model. That's right. Right. So my claim isn't that you can't take the standard model, embed it in a non-abelian gauge theory, and get couplings. But so again, my statement isn't about all theories. It's just about the theory that I'm talking about, which is the standard model plus this extra stuff. But just to again emphasize, why do I like this? Well, I tell you the real reason is that okay. So this is the same picture. Let me just skip it because I have no time. But it's a proof of concept. It's kind of a toy, My expectation would be that one of those exceptions would happen before this would be valid, certainly. But it does have an observational consequence, which is that there is a long-range force, because there's not many things you can gauge and not break in the standard model. In fact, the UNV minus L is the one, right? So we gauge it, and that looks like a violation of the equivalence principle, because it's a fifth force which interacts with ball bearings and leptons. You might worry that we're totally excluded, because those bounds are famously extremely, extremely stringent. But as it turns out, they're not stringent enough to kill us off yet. So I'm actually over. But another model you can work out is to basically just take dark matter and millicharge it. Okay, same principle. You give it, in this case, the reason why the Higgs-VEV correlates with anything in this picture is because the dark matter has some non-vanishing coupling to the Higgs, like some 0.1 coupling to the Higgs boson. It gets some of its mass from the Higgs, so if the VEV was larger, then MCO would be larger. Okay, so let me wrap up. So I've showed that there is an interesting interplay between naturalness and various ultraviolet consistency conditions. In particular, there are just natural parameter regions of minimal scalar QED, which can never arise from any ultraviolet completion. In our paper, we also extended the weak gravity conjecture to involve just generic numbers of forces, and there's kind of an interesting bound which scales non-trivially with the number of forces you have. And I commented on some kind of future work and work in progress regarding trying to provide more evidence for the weak gravity conjecture from superluminality in certain backgrounds. And if there really is, I guess, some maybe lesson to take from this, I would say, you know, maybe we should be a little more skeptical of little hierarchies. For some reason, I left this thinking more that maybe we shouldn't be so worried when we see them. And I don't know, maybe that also applies to big hierarchies. Okay, thank you. That's it.
Thank you.